One quick note before we begin this episode, there's a big question among Old Testament scholars as to the exact identity of the king in this episode. There are a few possibilities, and you'll hear that I've chosen one of them and leaned into that in my telling of the story. That's not to say that I'm right, it's just to say that I think there's a good reason for this choice, and when you're telling a story like this, you've got to choose something. If you're interested in why I made this decision, keep an eye out for the next issue of The Latest. It's the email that I send out every couple of weeks. It's free. You can sign up at holyghoststories.org. Thanks. Good counsel is a precious thing. Its absence fetters leadership, limits it to the inevitable weaknesses of a singular point of view. In its presence, though, any wisdom finds multiplication. And if the counsel is divinely inspired, the increase is exponential. This is a story about losing what's valuable and realizing, in the midst of the ensuing panic, that the greatest of treasures are held by hands sturdier than our own. It's a story about trust and providence and common grace. And it's a story about a God who so often has more than one objective in mind. I'm Justin Gerhardt. Welcome to Holy Ghost Stories. He stretches his broad-chested body, blinking awake in the darkness. Immediately, he feels it, that familiar pain in his midsection and the tinge of anger it provokes. He's hungry. He breathes deeply through his nose, hoping for clues that someone might be bringing a meal to begin his day. Nothing. He sniffs in disappointment. Yawns, nuzzles the sleeping form next to him. All 400 pounds of him drifts back to sleep, saving his energy for when it's needed next. Hopefully, that will be soon. He'll often eat up to 88 pounds of meat in a single sitting, and with every day that passes, he grows more ravenous. The other lions do as well. Of course, this is a calculated hunger, orchestrated with violent strategy by the most powerful regime in the world. The deprivation of this captive pride of lions will ensure the horrific demise of whoever's unfortunate enough to be thrown into their pit. King of the world. What else would you call someone who rules over a kingdom more vast than any empire in history? Perhaps simply the great. These are, in fact, the appellations granted to the unequaled Cyrus, known in Persia as Kurosh, and eventually remembered by one sacred text as Darius, a name that will later be shared by a successor. Never has the earth seen a king who conquered at will like this. First Ecbatana in the east, joining the Medes and the Persians, then Lydia and Anatolia in the west, then, shockingly, Babylon, and then more. Entire city-states voluntarily submitting to the hegemony of the colossal Achaemenid Empire. Media, Persia, Babylonia, Darius cannot lose. And why not? He's skilled, to be sure, but this feels like something more than military prowess or a strategic mind or fortuitous circumstances. This feels like destiny. And if Darius suspects that this is the case, that fate itself has written out this path for him, he's close. ...120 satraps. This empire needs unity, supervision, leadership. And I cannot do it alone. Officials and advisors and attendants all nod in response to their king. We'll divide the territory into as many provinces. Each satrap will govern a province and report to me. Darius moves to the window and looks out over the newly conquered city of Babylon. So many people. Not his property. His responsibility. Remnants of the festivities still litter the streets. Just days ago, the people welcomed the Achaemenid forces with open arms, hailing Darius as a deliverer, happy to bid farewell to the elderly Nabonidus and his loathsome son, Belshazzar. The king's eyes sweep across the expanse of the city, then move to the horizon. I need men who understand what it is to rule and what it is not. He turns and his officials are watching him. Whenever you can, act as a liberator. Darius looks from face to face. Freedom, dignity, wealth. These three together constitute the greatest happiness of humanity. If you bequeath all three to your people, their love for you will never die. The men nod intently. Something like this, surely, as Darius takes his place as ruler of yet more territory. And then, something like this as well. I want names in front of me in 3 days. The officials rush away in quick obedience to the king's command. One of them, though, pauses on his way out and offers an immediate suggestion. Your Majesty, I have several good choices for someone here in this prov... But Darius immediately shakes his head. No, I know who I want for Babylon. Over the next few months, Darius works to ensure a smooth transition in this recent addition to his empire. He keeps a close watch on his soldiers, disallowing them from roaming the streets of Babylon and bullying the citizens. He issues strict orders. Peace will be kept and violence will not do. He welcomes leaders and representatives from far and wide who've traveled to pay him tribute and pledge their allegiance. Two, he makes a point of restoring the region's worship practices. Nabonidus forcefully relocated all of the gods from outlying towns, moving them into the capital city, presumably in an effort to curry divine favor by way of proximity. Understandably, this had upset the people of district after district, Nabonidus wrenching their deities away from them for his own insecure purposes. Darius shakes his head. One final foolish move from an inept ruler. So few kings seem to understand. More than anything else, leadership has to do with the hearts of those you lead. And their religion, well, disrupt that, and you'll pay the price. Without delay, Darius restores these gods to their proper places, repopulating the temples and high places scattered throughout the land. There is much to do. But even in the midst of this busyness, the king cannot help but notice something. Someone. With every month, every week, it seems, Darius discovers how right his instincts were. The man he insisted on placing over Babylon, well, not only has he governed the province expertly, he's distinguished himself from every other administrator in startling ways. Led impeccably, counseled invaluably, been an ally, even a mentor to Darius, a rare gift to be sure. Daniel of Jerusalem, such a strange old man in some ways, worshiping that God who lost the battle to Babylon decades ago. But so, where do you start? Wise, generous, intelligent, diligent, regal, even. It helps that he knows Babylon, of course. He's lived here for, what, 60 years? And during all of it, he's been a counselor of kings, one regime after another, recognizing Daniel's otherness and making sure that he sat at the highest tables and advised in the most complicated situations. Word is, it began all the way back in Nebuchadnezzar's reign, when Daniel was, well, a teenager. And he knows things, secret things, like the meaning of the writing on the wall in Belshazzar's feast foretelling the Achaemenid conquest of Babylon. What is it about him? Whatever it is, Darius will not be the first fool to miss out on it. In fact, he calls for an attendant. Send for Daniel. This is not a public move, but somewhere in the darkness, listening ears soak up every word, make connections, hatch a plan. This Jew doesn't even belong here. He should not be ruling Babylon, and he certainly should not be elevated to the position Darius is planning over the whole kingdom. No. Envy percolates. Inky, viscous bubbles rising and bursting in the hearts of the other satraps and administrators. Surely there are skeletons in Daniel's closet. Time to catch him out. Corruption. Negligence. Who isn't guilty of a little of one or the other? The satraps embark on an unholy quest, prompted by an unflinching faith in the universal depravity of humankind. Exhibit A, their own ignoble hearts. Now, to discover Daniel's hidden iniquity, expose it to the king, and build a future for themselves from the wreckage. But days pass with no fruit. They whisper questions to Babylonian officials, review accounting records, offer payoffs to loose-lipped informants. Weeks go by and nothing. They meet again in the shadows. We will never find any basis for charges against this man. Heads shake in frustration. And then a murmur, perhaps, from an unseen devil. A suggestion. An answer. The eyes of one of the men light up. Unless, the other heads turn, unless it has something to do with the law of his God. Wry smiles all around. May King Darius live forever. The king nods and gestures for this group of satraps to enter the throne room. He watches as they approach. The royal administrators, prefects, satraps, advisors, and governors have all agreed. Darius chuckles to himself. Really? That's got to be a first. The satraps continue, they have all agreed that the king should issue an edict and enforce the decree that anyone who prays to any god or human being during the next 30 days, except to you, your majesty, shall be thrown into the lion's den. Darius considers this. What they're suggesting, it seems, is a month in which he, as king, would be a sole liaison between the people and their gods. They would pray to their deities of choice, but through him. This could galvanize the region. He's already demonstrated his support of the people's spiritual practices. This would show his connection to their gods, establish him not just as their king, but as their high priest pro tem. All of the satraps and governors are in agreement? Yes, your majesty. The lie is flawless. Another satrap speaks up.
Now, your majesty, issue the decree and put it in writing so that it cannot be altered, in accordance with the law of the Medes and the Persians, which cannot be repealed.
Yes, Darius nods. A wise practice, this, the immutability of certain commands. Kings may come and go, but law must endure.
Bring the scribes.
A pair of sandaled feet travels through the streets, enters a home, climbs the stairs, up, 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 and then down. Legs fold and knees rest on the carpeted floor. Leathered hands rise to the heavens as Daniel gazes out his window toward Jerusalem. Or what was Jerusalem? 400 years ago, King Solomon stood atop Mount Zion before the newly completed Temple of Yahweh and prayed words that Daniel learned surely as a boy in Jerusalem, not long before Nebuchadnezzar came crashing in and carried him and others away to Babylon. These words. When your people Israel have been defeated by an enemy because they have sinned against you, when the heavens are shut up and there is no rain, and when they pray toward this place and give praise to your name and turn from their sin, then hear from heaven and forgive the sin of your servants, your people Israel. Daniel knows that Solomon's beautiful temple has been gone for ages, lost to the violent will of Nebuchadnezzar, lost to the relentless waywardness of the Israelites. And so he doesn't pray toward the temple as much as he prays toward the memory of the temple, the memory of a place inhabited by the radiant presence of Yahweh, the memory of a home. The waves of his snowy beard flutter in the breeze that blows through the window. Daniel closes his eyes, feels the air on his cheeks. The carpet beneath his knees is frayed. He bows here 3 times a day, every day. This is not a discipline. It is existence itself. And as he kneels to pray on this day, the very day the royal edict on prayer is made public, does the new law outlawing what Daniel is about to do give him pause? It seems the answer is, quite simply, no. On his worn carpet, his skin painted gold as the sun beds down in the west, Daniel thanks his God, just as he did yesterday and the 20,000 days before that. Yahweh smiles. He loves this time with his son. But somewhere outside, or from a nearby window, just as Daniel asks Yahweh for help, somewhere in the darkness, watching eyes take note, confirm suspicions, hatch a plan.
Did you not publish a decree that during the next 30 days, anyone who prays to any god or human being, except you, your majesty, would be thrown into the lion's den?
King Darius raises an eyebrow. He is no fool. What are these representatives of the satraps up to? He answers warily, "The decree stands in accordance with the law of the Medes and the Persians, which cannot be repealed." A self-satisfied smile on their faces, a theatrical bow. "Oh, King, it pains us to inform you that Daniel, one of those exiles from Judah, pays no attention to you, Your Majesty, or to the decree you put in writing." An enthusiastic nod from another one of the satraps. "Yes, he still prays to Yahweh 3 times a day. Darius feels his throat tighten. A vice closes on his chest. "No, Daniel, of course. Why didn't he think of the room, his attendants, the conniving sycophants? Everything disappears. The king's mind races. I must do something. But no something's come to mind. Panic spreads like spilled ink. What can I do?" From that moment, the king of the world exhausts every possibility. Loopholes, replacement edicts, indefinite stays of execution. Hours race by, and when the sun sets, Darius has found no way to save Daniel of Judah. The last glimpses of the day's light vanish. And then the voice of an attendant. "Sire, the satraps are here again. They are requesting another. Send them in." "Remember, Your Majesty," they chorus in feigned obeisance, "that according to the law of the Medes and the Persians, no decree or edict that the king issues can be changed." Why would they return like this? Why would they feel compelled to remind the king of this rule? If it was not clear to Darius before, it clicks into focus now. Daniel was their target all along. And now that the trap has been set and the prey has been caught, they want to make sure the slaughter goes without a hitch. They stand there, waiting, salivating. Darius curses himself. There is no escape from this. No one can save Daniel now. The king looks to an attendant. "Prepare the lions." Decibels of noise echoes from the pit. The sound carries for no less than 5 miles. One guttural explosion, then another, and another. The bone-chilling sequence lasts a full 40 seconds. Out of all the species of big cat, only individual lions will roar together. A collective declaration of multiplied power. Ropes squeeze the thin, mottled skin of the old man's wrists. The satraps look on with sick anticipation. The soldiers move the prisoner forward to a platform, perhaps thick ropes at 4 corners looped around pulleys suspended above. Inside the pit, the lions pace. Daniel's breathing is steady. King Darius, on the other hand, is anything but calm. Apology wells in his eyes as he looks for what he knows is the last time at his mentor, his partner, his electric link to the divine. "This regal creature will be a casualty of my foolishness." Or perhaps, "Daniel!" Darius's voice trembles with emotion. "May your God, whom you serve continually, rescue you." It is not faith, but it is an embryo, the tiny, wriggling beginning of something. A great stone seals the opening. The king's own signet ring marks the seal. The rings of the nobles as well. No one can change Daniel's sentence. The old man is lowered into the pit. The stone will be rolled away in the morning, and whatever remains will be removed. Darius spends the rest of the evening in a trance. He returns to the palace for dinner, but he cannot make himself eat. Attendants bring musicians and players to offer diversion, but the king waves them away. He retires to his chambers, but there is no chance of sleep. Darius stares into the dark, and his imagination supplies a gruesome, imagined soundtrack. The roaring of lions, the tearing of flesh, the screams of his cherished partner, the snapping of bones. How many deaths has Darius been responsible for? And yet this one is more than he can bear. Involuntarily, he rehearses the interactions he and Daniel have shared over these past months. The counsel, so incisive and kind. The wise sayings that still swirl in his mind. And during those long, silent hours, something else as well. Questions. Why would Daniel refuse to obey the edict? Everyone else did. What would he have lost had he followed the king's command? Surely not more than he's lost tonight. What a foolish... No, that word has no place in the company of this man. Wisdom seeps from his pores. And so why? What is it about Yahweh that inspires such... And the peace on Daniel's face as they watched him disappear into the darkness. Darius has all the treasures in the world, and they pale in comparison to what it seems this elderly Jew possesses. And then the king's thoughts are interrupted by the first flashings of dawn. Darius shoots out of bed, throws on some clothing, and runs. Servants stand agape at the sight of their king rushing through the corridors of the palace, hurtling toward the lion's den. Before he even gets there, he's yelling, calling to the man he realized just last night perhaps is his friend. Daniel, servant of the living God! Has your God, whom you serve continually, been able to rescue you from the lions? Darius scrapes at the seal, calling for slaves to come and move the stone, hoping, praying, waiting. And then... May the king live forever. Darius's eyes well with tears. It's him. That's his voice. Impossible. How? My God sent his angel, and he shut the mouths of the lions. He sounds so relaxed. They have not hurt me, because I was found innocent in his sight. Nor have I ever done anything wrong before you, your majesty. Darius is crying now. The stone is gone, and he's shouting for them to lift Daniel out. In moments, the old man is standing before the king, who's turning him around, moving his hands over Daniel's chest and arms and neck, incredulous. Not a wound. Daniel smiles, puts his furrowed hand on the king's shoulder. I trusted in my God. When the king's soldiers knock on the doors of the colluding satraps, are they surprised? Surely not. Terrified, but not surprised. They're bound and transported, along with their wives and children, in the direction of the echoing roars. The platform lowers, and before it even reaches the floor, gives rise to a gruesome, unimagined soundtrack. The snarling of lions, the tearing of flesh, the screams of men and women and children, the snapping of bones. Bring the scribes. In the days following Daniel's deliverance, King Darius dictates a message. It's translated into language after language and sent to every corner of the vast Achaemenid Empire. It begins with a sentiment uncommon among men with this kind of power, but such is Darius's character, and the greeting is the least surprising bit by far. May you prosper greatly. I issue a decree that in every part of my kingdom, people must fear and reverence the God of Daniel. And then a poem, a song, perhaps. In the nights that came after that horrible, sleepless one, did the king of the world write a song about, well, his most recent acquisition? Not a city-state or an empire brought under his control, but a new addition to the landscape of his heart. Faith in this God called Yahweh. For he is the living God, and he endures forever. His kingdom will not be destroyed. His dominion will never end. He rescues and he saves. He performs signs and wonders in the heavens and on the earth. He has rescued Daniel from the power of the lions. And what about that guiding belief to which Darius held so tightly? Disrupt your subject's religion and you pay the price. Well, more than anything else, leadership has to do with the hearts of those you lead. And if Yahweh is the key to their hearts being made like Daniel's, no price is too much. It won't last for Darius, this nascent faith. Beautiful as it is, it will find itself crowded into the cacophony of syncretism. But who's to say that the king's proclamation doesn't lead someone, many perhaps, to trust in the God who shuts the mouths of lions, quenches the fury of flames, turns weakness into strength? Surely it's more than Daniel and Darius Yahweh has in mind with all of this. He loves so many, and he calls to them even now in the rain he sends and the food he provides, the laughter he enables, and the songs he inspires. In fact, this open door in Darius's heart will be used to even greater effect in the days to come. Yahweh, God of the universe, who made Darius king of the world, has plans to steal the shadows and send light skittering across creation. Plans for redemption and restoration, plans for global resurrection. And the entire scheme hinges on a group of people brought with Daniel to Babylon, who've been held captive there for decades. People who need to go home. It will be Darius, known also as Cyrus the Great, who makes this happen. He will free the Jews and enable their return to Israel, and will even fund the reconstruction of the temple. Yahweh will call him My Anointed because of the work he does, unawares, of course, to prepare the way for another Anointed One. The Anointed One. Lion of the tribe of Judah. Hey, Justin here. I hope this episode blessed you. I can't believe it took us 5 seasons to get to Daniel and the Lion's Den. I'm glad we finally made it. If you haven't gotten your tickets for one of the Exodus shows that are happening in April, you should definitely do that. Kendall Ramseur and I are bringing a night of beauty and truth, story and song to 6 cities next month. So if you're anywhere near Huntsville, Alabama, Jackson, Tennessee, Little Rock, Arkansas, Oklahoma City, Oklahoma, Austin, Texas, or Fort Worth, Texas, you should definitely join us. Live cello, the epic story of Moses and Yahweh, a female vocalist who will bring tears to your eyes. I really think you're going to love this. Cities, dates, and tickets are on the website, holyghoststories.org. Oh, and in most of the cities, we're doing a pre-show bonus. It's a meet and greet and Q&A thing with Kendall and myself before the show that you can add to your ticket at purchase. There's a limited number of spots per show, but we'd love to be able to meet you guys and chat about the Exodus or my research trip to Egypt or the process of collaborating or anything else you fancy. And anyone who grabs the pre-show bonus gets a guaranteed front of house seat. We hope to see you out there in April. Get your tickets at holyghoststories.org. Finally, a shout out to the Raconteurs, who, along with the other generous patrons of this show, make it possible for us to tell these stories and share them on multiple continents. Steve, Easton, Sean, Joey at Creation to Revelation, Ryan and Kelly, Miranda, Amanda, Carrie, Joy, John, Joshua, David, Teresa, Daniel, Deborah, Terry, Rachel, Valerie, Travis, Steve, Shannon, Kara, Dawn, Jean-Paul, Brenda, Tiffany, Sarah, Beth, Daniel, Stephanie, Helen, Hildy, Debbie, Susan, Rick, Stephanie, Derek, Mindy, Maddie, Jody, Jonathan, Ricky, Brandy, Mark, Kimmy, Stephen, Patrick, Liz, Stevens, Terry, Nelwyn, Julie, Aaron, Jamie, Bill and Trina, Jessica, Ken, Alyssa, Sloan, and Jamie. Congrats to you on putting 5 seasons of Holy Ghost Stories into the world. Holy Ghost Stories is a production of Hayesfire Studios, manuscript editing by J.L. Gerhart, research, writing, narration, and sound editing by me, Justin Gerhart. Till next time.